Good evening, everyone. Tonight's talk is called Giving Up Without Giving In. I'd like to open tonight's talk with a description of what a Japanese Zen monk must do if he wishes to enter a training monastery to practice intensive meditation. When he first reaches the entrance hall, he kneels down on a small step and calls out in a loud voice. An older monk appears, and the young aspirant politely requests entry. Bidding the applicant to wait, the older monk disappears into the monastery. He returns after some time and conveys the verdict that the newcomer's request has been refused, usually with a reason like the monastery is presently full or that provisions are too meagre. Upon rejection, the young monk retires to a corner out of the way, kneels down with forehead on the ground, and waits in earnest supplication until he is granted permission to enter the monastery. Soon after, another monk emerges, usually wielding a stick, and very rudely demands that the newcomer leaves. He does not withdraw, however, and the angry monk then follows up his tongue lashing with jabs, kicks, and thrusts, and manhandles the youngster out of the gate. However, once he knows the coast is clear, the young monk skulks back to his position in the corner and begins kneeling again. This whole scene is reenacted repeatedly until eventually the angry monk no longer appears. The young monk is then left quite alone, kneeling in humble supplication. Amazingly, he might be left like that for anything up to 3 days, until the monastery authorities are convinced that he shows at least some measure of desire to practice. Undoubtedly, this is an extreme experience to go through, and might at first glance appear cruel. But there is an underlying principle at work, one which needs to be recognized by anyone intent on walking a spiritual path. Here's a quote from Zen master Soko Morinaga, who went through that 3-day ordeal. "Here I was, my mind vacillating, wondering why I had to be in a place like this, in this pitiful state. It is very easy to waver. When I saw my own wavering, I understood for the first time the significance of being made to keep crawling back. The monk is forced to renew his original resolution, to strengthen that resolution, to resolve again, and to bolster that resolution still further. Practicing insight meditation and beating out a path to enlightenment is not easy. Some say climbing Mount Everest would be easier. The Buddha's teaching is one of renunciation, renouncing the causes of our suffering. There are many times in the practice when we are confronted with the stark realities of our attachments to the world, and the struggle to give them up can be difficult. So accustomed are we to the attachment being there that it can almost feel like we are being asked to renounce the essence of life itself. As Tapusa, the householder, once said to the Buddha, 'Venerable Sir, we are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality. For us, renunciation is like jumping off a cliff.' In reply, the Buddha stated that it was necessary to see the genuine drawbacks in worldly desires. This then leads naturally to an understanding of the rewards of renunciation. Becoming familiar with such rewards, the Buddha said, the heart leaps up at renunciation, grows confident, steadfast, and firm, seeing it as peace. However, before that happens, there will be many times when it will appear vastly more attractive to give up the training than our attachments. Our minds will waver, just like the Zen monk. This is why he is put through that arduous introduction to monastic life. Those 3 days cause him to reflect in utter seriousness about why exactly he wishes to practice meditation. This process conditions in such determination that on occasions when the mind does waver, he can generate sufficient resolve to see him through. So in that spirit, tonight's talk is all about how to give up without giving in. Undoubtedly, there is much pleasure and happiness to be found in the world. There are gross physical enjoyments like food, drink, and music. At a more refined level, art, theatre, and photography can offer just as much pleasure. Great delight can be found in purely mental pursuits too, like philosophy, for instance, or higher mathematics. Alternatively, some seek happiness through the eradication of aspects of the world we find displeasing. So we enter into politics, charitable work, or alternative therapies, in the hope of changing life for the better. The Buddha never denied that such endeavours could produce happiness, but he insisted that the resultant pleasures were transient and therefore unsatisfactory. Unfortunately, out of ignorance, we continue to pursue worldly pleasure and happiness and suffer repeatedly because the pleasure and happiness don't last and cannot truly satisfy. The Buddha stated that true happiness is available to us, but can only be found by renouncing what is worldly, transient, and limited, and seeking instead what is transcendental, permanent, and unlimited. To do so, we adopt a reverse psychology. We forego the process of always trying to acquire happiness through worldly means, and instead engage in a process of renunciation. By giving up our passionate attachments to the world, we gradually reach the point where all attempts to accumulate end. In the absence of all desire, the mind is unperturbed, and in that stillness we discover the ever-present, but ever ignored, transcendental happiness of Nibbana. So what is renunciation? Put simply, renunciation is the willingness to make an intelligent sacrifice. An intelligent sacrifice is one where you gain a greater happiness by letting go of a lesser one, in the same way you'd give up a bag of sweets if offered a pot of gold in exchange. So what does following a path of renunciation mean in practical terms? When we first come along to the centre, we are told that meditation is only effective if there is a real, strong, and determined commitment to its development. To this end, we are encouraged to meditate every day, to observe the 5 precepts, to practice sense restraint, moderation in eating, and contentment with little. In doing these things, we are immediately brought face to face with the reality of our attachments. And what then ensues is a tug of war between our worldly desires and our spiritual aspirations. Inevitably, the mind wavers. It's Wednesday night, 6:30 p.m. You're just in from work, and there's just enough time to eat a quick sandwich and still make it to the centre. But you're tired. Can you really be bothered? Another night, you're about to go and meditate. Then you realise Buffy the Vampire Slayer is about to come on BBC Two. For some, a real dilemma. A boozy Sunday lunch at the pub has long been a ritual for you and your partner. But will choosing to refrain from drinking cause a rift? Challenges like these are an essential part of the spiritual endeavour. Confronting our gross physical cravings like this is how we develop wisdom. Consider, in these situations, we will always be confronted with a choice: the pain of indulgence or the pain of renunciation. For instance, if we succumb to slouching in front of the telly rather than meditating, we may initially feel pleasure, but that soon gives way to a feeling of failure and consequent self-loathing because we reneged on our intentions. However, renouncing the TV in order to meditate may initially be painful as we drag ourselves off the sofa, but this action will ultimately result in a growing sense of self-esteem through succeeding with our intentions. The trick is to establish enough mindfulness so that we know what we are doing. Then we will always have a choice and consider both options equally. With time and practical application, we develop the understanding of what is truly in our best interest. We know from our own experience that we always feel so much better for renouncing rather than habitually indulging. But a note of warning: a mistake some fall into is to confuse renunciation with the extreme of asceticism. The object of our desires is not the problem, and simply getting rid of it doesn't really change anything. Rather, it is the attachment to the object that needs to be understood and overcome. To illustrate, before entering the monastery, I remember seeing an advert on TV. It showed black and white footage of a man with a shaved head and no shirt, sitting earnestly in meditation by a very cold-looking mountain lake. The advert then showed the same man dreaming at night. In his dreams, he was behind the wheel of a fast, colourful sports car. He was full of joy and having a wonderful time zooming around the mountain roads. The footage then cuts back to him by the mountain lake the next morning, as he starts whipping himself on the back, punishing himself for being so weak. The man was trying what many meditators are prone to do. He was attempting to find inner calm by squashing his desires out of existence through control. This is not renunciation, and is actually a cause of yet more agitation. His actions will merely intensify the resistance he feels next time he experiences similar dreams. He isn't getting rid of his attachment at all. In fact, he's making it stronger. Most people see suppression as very self-destructive and instead opt for a bit of indulgence. But this technique fares no better. The trouble is, as one teacher put it, sensual pleasures are like salty water. The more you drink, the thirstier you get. You can never get to the point of being permanently gratified. And taken to extremes, indulgence can turn into addiction and depravity. Although not recognized by the world at large, there is an alternative approach, what the Buddha called the middle way. Here, instead of either suppressing or acting upon our desires, we acknowledge and accept their existence. We then mindfully observe the transient, unsatisfactory, and conditioned nature of both the desire and its object. It is through wisdom, generated by simple, mindful observation of reality, that we abandon passionate desires, not through control. The three marks are real characteristics inherent in all aspects of worldly life. This is not something invented by the Buddha. Through mindfulness and meditation, we see that it is actually so. As a result, we come to the intelligent conclusion that to cling passionately to the things of the world is not in our best interest, and we let them go. Hence we avoid both the pain of denial and the pain of indulgence. And with time, the thirst for sensuality is whittled away, naturally and spontaneously. So what could be easier? We just sit down and simply observe the true nature of existence. Given enough time, all our passionate desires and consequently all our suffering will be eradicated. Brilliant. Unfortunately, as we all know, meditation isn't that easy. Our attempts to still the mind enough to observe reality are forever being hindered. In the early days, doubts can arise about the Buddha, his enlightenment, about the effectiveness of the teaching or the teachers. Alternatively, we suffer self-doubt about our own ability to meditate. Resistance to practicing might arise because we discover that meditation is actually rather more difficult than we had initially supposed. And when the five hindrances to meditation kick in, as inevitably they will, sitting can become very frustrating and might even seem to be going in the wrong direction. At such times, we might be sorely tempted to give in. This is when we really need the courage of the Zen monk to renew and strengthen our resolve, to generate sufficient determination to see us through this turbulent phase. After all, although temporarily painful, what we are engaged in is hugely advantageous to us. To help counter any wavering, we could recollect why we chose to meditate in the first place and get back in touch with our original intention. Alternatively, we might think about the advantages that following this path has already brought us in terms of peace, clarity, and understanding. Perhaps we could bring to mind the inspiring story of someone who has trodden the way of renunciation before us, the Buddha himself, for instance, or Alan and Jackie James, and recollect that they too must have passed through these same problems. We need also to recognize that we have courageously chosen to look at what we have normally preferred to ignore. To acknowledge the true extent of our suffering is the first wise step towards bringing it to an end. Whenever we experience turbulence in the meditation, we need to remember that there is always an underlying cause. The hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, worry and doubt are all movements of mind which attempt to find satisfaction by escaping the reality of that moment, either through the acquisition of something we find desirable or by eradicating what we consider undesirable. Now, although this might sound a bit controversial, the presence of the hindrances can often be a blessing, admittedly in disguise. They're like an alarm call, alerting us to the fact that there may well be an underlying issue that requires our attention. What is it that we are so willfully trying to ignore? For instance, a meditator who routinely employs too much effort in the meditation and consequently suffers extreme agitation is instructed to sit and do nothing. In complying with the instruction, she finds that she is swamped by feelings of guilt because, in worldly terms, she would be perceived as not being productive. This conditions an intense urge to force the pace of the meditation in order to gain tangible evidence of progress and so allay the guilt. Whenever we discover such tendencies warping and undermining our meditation, it can feel as if we have chanced upon hidden treasure. Often at these moments, we will experience delightful rapture, and our confidence in the teaching will swell. This is the nature of renunciation. We make an intelligent sacrifice, abandon our normal mental shenanigans, and in return, we grow in wisdom. So the workaholic begins to recognize the nature of her own conditioning. She also now appreciates that there is a profound difference between the wisdom of non-action and the activity of laziness. There are a whole range of hidden tendencies that surface through meditation. Some meditators, for instance, enjoy diving into deeply concentrated states and don't apply themselves to observing the three marks. While it is undoubtedly true that such meditation can bring about the cessation of suffering, it can do so only temporarily. Compared with the diamonds and pearls of insight wisdom, concentration is merely fool's gold. For permanent liberation from suffering, we have to be willing to renounce attachment to blissful mental states just as much as gross physical pleasures. Observing closely the workings of mind and body with the tools of insight, we come to recognize the utterly uncontrollable nature of reality. This knowledge brings to light another area of our experience where renunciation is required. We realize that we simply do not have the power over the world that we have always assumed we had. The effect of this is that we begin to let go of our idealism in favor of a more pragmatic and realistic attitude. For example, many meditators find that their passionate interest in politics begins to fizzle away. It's not that we become apathetic, far from it. It is rather that we begin to place more emphasis on ensuring that our own conduct is blameless. An attitude born from that very same insight into conditionality. Permanently eliminating craving and hatred within our own nature is infinitely more effective in bringing peace than trying to put right all the wrongs of the external world. So far tonight, we have looked at why it is that pleasure and happiness gained through worldly means are unsatisfactory, and why the Buddha recommended following a path of renunciation. To follow such a path requires courage and resolve. All the way through, we are presented with obstacles which sorely test us. But these challenges are the very stuff of the practice itself, and whenever we face them, rather than trying to escape them, we grow in wisdom. At the heart of all this endless pursuit of worldly happiness and the cause of all possible suffering is one single misconception about the nature of reality. It is also no surprise that this aspect of the Buddha's teaching causes people the most difficulty and is the greatest hurdle to overcome. It is, of course, the doctrine of anatta, non-self. Undoubtedly, undeniably, the idea that the much-vaunted self does not really exist is a very difficult concept to grasp. In order to get a handle on it, some meditators try using reason and logic, believing that the answer is to fully understand anatta intellectually. But it needs to be remembered that no one can think their way to enlightenment. The total understanding of non-self can only come about through the closest possible scrutiny of reality. In point of fact, thinking, reason, and logic must themselves be subjected to mindful observation by way of the three marks and ultimately renounced as a way to peace and happiness. It is only seeing directly anicca, dukkha, and anatta in all possible mental and physical processes that reveals the true workings of self-view. When this truth has finally been realized, we are said to be enlightened. At this point, the process of renunciation comes to an end. We see that attempts to find peace through worldly means are based on this mistaken principle. By giving up self-view, all passionate attachments conditioned by it are also given up. In the absence of any such desire, the mind remains unperturbed, and in that stillness, we discover what we have always been ignoring, the ever-present transcendental happiness of Nibbana. To illustrate this, imagine that you are standing on the psychological equivalent of a hamster's wheel. Ahead of you are all the worldly avenues to peace and happiness you could ever wish for, and behind you is everything you find irksome, unpleasant, and downright painful. What do? You start running, of course, running towards peace and happiness and away from pain and anguish. Days, weeks, years, and even lifetimes pass by. You spend your time indulging the senses, bringing up families, getting ahead in your career, forming political parties, taking over countries, creating dynasties. You learn to speak other languages, to play musical instruments, and try alternative therapies, martial arts, even meditation. Then, somewhere along the line, you take a look at how far you've come. To your dismay, you find that you are still standing on the hamster's wheel. You still see all the peace and happiness you could ever wish for ahead of you, and everything you find irksome, unpleasant, and painful behind you. You realize to your horror that for all that effort, for all those lifetimes of endeavor, you have gone absolutely nowhere. So now what do? Do you start running again? Or do you simply step off the wheel once and for all? Enlightenment is to step off this wheel once and for all. And what's that like? Upon going beyond the world, the Buddha himself said, "This truly is peace. This is sublime. That is to say, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishment of all attachment, the ending of all craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana." Allen also adds, "But that is not all. Having given up acquisition, we now find that everything we ever wanted comes to us. But there is a great and fundamental difference. Now we do not care if we get those things or if they pass us by. We rest content with whatever we have or do not have, and the world turns as it must." Following the Buddha's path of renunciation means giving up our bag of sweets for a pot of pure gold. It means giving up our suffering for the peace of Nibbana. "I'll make a trade," one of the Buddha's disciples once said. "Aging for the ageless, burning for the unbound, the highest peace, the unexcelled safety from bondage." To follow the Buddha's path is, quite simply, the best investment you could ever make. Thank you.